the United States. So fortunately, English is becoming an international language, and we're literally drawing people from around the world. Okay, I want to jump in to the passages we talked about the last time I was here. However, between the last time I was here, 2 weeks ago, and today, there's been a major discovery that I got to talk to you about. Why? Because it's the greatest scientific collaborative research ever done in the history of mankind. That happened, literally, just a few weeks ago. It got published last week. What happened was on August 17th, the gravity wave telescopes, there's two of them now. There's one here in the United States called LIGO, Laser Interferometry Gravitational Wave Observatory, called LIGO for short. And it's two gravitational wave telescopes, one in the state of Washington and Hanford. Say, why did they pick Hanford? Well, that's the place where they were developing the atomic bomb during World War II. They got a large facility where they keep the public out. And they wanted a place that was nice and quiet, this thing is big. What a laser interferometer is, it's basically a long tube, 4 kilometers long, with mirrors at both ends. And they shoot laser beams back and forth between the two mirrors. And they got two arms at right angles to one another. So 4 kilometers here, and at right angles another 4 kilometers. And what they're doing is they're very carefully measuring the distance between the two mirrors with the goal of detecting gravitational waves. Now, gravity is the weakest of the four forces of physics. In order to be able to detect gravitational waves, this thing is so well engineered and designed that it can measure the distance between the two mirrors over 4 kilometers to an accuracy of 1/10 the diameter of a proton. It's by far the most sophisticated machine that humanity has ever built. In fact, in my talks, I often compare the fine-tuning of the universe with the fine-tuning of this LIGO instrument, because that's the epitome of human achievement. And I can tell you, God's design is orders and orders of magnitude more spectacular than the design in this LIGO. But hey, that's pretty spectacular to be able to make measurements to 1/10 of a proton over a length scale of 4 kilometers. Now, the problem is this, is that if a truck drives by, it causes the mirrors to move like this. Or if a wave crashes on the beach 300 miles away, that's enough to cause the mirrors to move. And the movement's bigger than what you would get from a gravitational wave disturbance somewhere else in the universe. And so they had to build a second one in Louisiana. So in Livingston, Louisiana, they have the identical system set up. And the whole idea is that a truck running by in Seattle is going to cause the two mirrors in Washington to move in a little different way than the two mirrors in Louisiana. Likewise, with the ocean waves hitting the beach 300 miles away, are going to disturb the mirrors in the two different locations in different ways. So that way, they just subtract out all the stuff caused by ground movement here on Earth. And if it's identical at both sites, then they know it's from outer space. And it was a year and a half ago where they found the first event. And this is two relatively big black holes, about 15 and 17 times the mass of the Sun, merging together. And when they merged together, the equivalent of 3 solar masses was converted into gravitational energy. And even though this object was located, 4 billion light years away, it was enough to cause the mirrors to move. They could actually see the signal from that merging event. So you need a major gravitational disturbance before you see anything at this site. Now, since then, they have found 3 more black hole mergers, all in very distant galaxies. And it was amazing. I wrote about it in my Facebook page and on my blog, because we didn't even know if black holes of that size even existed. Seeing the merger tells us, yeah, they really do exist, and that's actually a big alteration in our understanding of the history of the universe. But what was exciting about August 17th of this year is it wasn't 2 black holes merging together, it was 2 neutron stars merging together. And there was a lot of doubt about whether this instrument was sensitive enough to even be able to pick up the gravitational signal from two merging neutron stars. Consequently, they upgraded the instrument. They did a major, so it's now called the Advanced LIGO. Advanced LIGO is actually sensitive enough to pick up neutron star mergers that are relatively nearby. And then they also brought in a separate gravity wave telescope called Virgo. Virgo is located in Pisa, Italy, just outside Pisa, Italy. So why did they pick that location? Well, it's Galileo's hometown, so they thought, hey, you know. Galileo was the first one to actually do experiments on gravity. Let's make sure it's near his hometown. And they found a place just outside of Pisa, which is relatively quiet. They were able to do this. So that's the third arm. And here's the goal. If you're actually going to have the capability of seeing neutron stars merging together, you have the potential to see a lot more. Okay, black holes are black. We all know a black hole is a massive body so dense that anything that gets close to it gets sucked into it, including light itself. And so you don't really see anything around a black hole. And when two black holes merge together, you got black and black merging together to be black. So you basically just see the gravitational wave. You don't see anything else. However, neutron stars are not black. They're very dense. I mean, if you're not familiar with a neutron star, you can take a star like about the size of the sun, typically a little bit bigger, and when it's done with its nuclear burning, it basically undergoes collapse, and it collapses down to the size of about 6 or 7 miles in diameter. So, our star is 70,000 miles in diameter. Take a body that big, shrink it down, and it becomes so dense that it's basically a liquid ball of neutrons touching one another from the core all the way up. So it's extremely dense. Molecules are impossible. Atoms are impossible there. Even electrons and protons can't exist because of the extreme gravitational force. So just think of it as a solid ball of neutrons. To give you an idea of the density, it comes in at about 2 billion tons per teaspoonful. Okay, so if you've got a little cup of coffee here, take a teaspoonful, dump it in, 2 billion tons. Okay? That's how dense it is. So yeah, two neutron stars merging together will give you a powerful gravitational wave. However, because there are two neutron stars merging together, it's not black. Now, it becomes a black hole. Two neutron stars that merge together merge and become a black hole. But before the merging event, there's a scattering of neutrons. And that scattering of neutrons, basically a debris cloud of neutrons around the merging event, is something you can see at every wavelength. So you're going to get a gamma ray signal, an X-ray signal, infrared, optical, ultraviolet, radio waves. And so when this thing was detected, and the gravitational wave signal lasted about 2 seconds, and then it was over. However, the light emission lasts for days. And so observatories were alerted around the world and said, hey, you've got to look at this thing. Because there is a great sense of anticipation. We're going to discover things we've never known before about the universe. And I'll give you the bottom line right away. The big result of it is fine-tuning. A brand new fine-tuning argument that shows the handiwork and the glory of God. Okay, I got a question here and then I'm going to go back into it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Black holes instead of collide. I guess there's a difference between.
Well, if we can turn the lights out for a bit, I'm going to show you a computer animation of what this event actually looked like. Okay, here we go. There's the two neutron stars spiraling around one another and getting closer and closer to one another. And yet you're going to see them merge together into a single body. And then you get this huge radiation of light at all different wavelengths as the two neutron stars merge into a black hole. Okay, that's on YouTube. So if you want to look at it again, we can. In fact, it's playing one more time. We can actually show it to you again. So let's... Yeah, and what the gravity wave telescope is able to pick up are those final in spirals just before it merges together. That's where they get the gravitational wave signal coming out. But what happened is that they alerted observatories around the world, you got to look at this thing. And so 70 different observatories around the world observed this thing, including space satellites, because gamma ray and X-ray and ultraviolet, that's all going to be done from outer space, with space satellites, infrared as well. The collaborative work involved 952 different research institutions, universities, institutions. Never before in the history of mankind has there been that big of a collaborative effort. The entire issue of Astrophysical Journal Letters, October 20th, was devoted to giving the results, not so much from the gravity wave, that was published elsewhere in Physical Review Letters, but they published all the papers on the results from these 70 different observatories. And here's the good news. They decided to make access to every one of those research papers in its entirety free to the public. So you can go to Astrophysical Journal Letters and you can read all the papers. That's how you can spend your afternoon today, reading all those exciting papers. Yeah, quick question, then I'll continue.
What's the typical period of the wave?
Okay, as I said, the waves are, there's gravity waves everywhere, but in order to detect it with these instruments, they have to be very powerful gravity waves. And in this case, they could see about the last 2 seconds before the merger event. Now, where you've got two black holes merging together, they can actually witness, I think the record is, one of them they saw 55 orbits before the merger event. They were able to see gravitational waves through the last 55 orbits of the two black holes together. In this case, because they're neutron stars, they didn't get that much data.
Is there the order of
we're talking 2 seconds.
2 seconds.
They got to see the last 2 seconds before the merger. Well, the wave comes at you at the velocity of light, so that's how fast gravity waves travel. But yeah, as it's going, as the two neutron stars are spiraling around one another, as they get closer and closer, you get gravitational waves emanating as they get closer and closer together. And yeah, it's very high frequency. Well, we're talking many cycles per second. Okay, because basically, in 2 seconds, you're probably seeing the last, I don't know the exact number, but probably the last 10 to 12 orbits before it merges. So you can figure out the frequency from that. Yeah, go ahead.
Are there also gravitational particles?
There are gravitational particles. We presume they are. That's part of Einstein's theory of general relativity, that you get gravity waves and you get gravitons. So gravitons would be the particles associated with the force of gravity. But again, because gravity is the weakest of the forces of physics, there's really no way we're ever going to detect a graviton. I don't know the exact size of the particle accelerator, but I'm just guessing. It would have to be billions of light years long. And the chances of that being funded in a Republican administration is relatively remote. So, yes.
How does this event contribute to more fine-tuning arguments?
That's where I'm going with this. Okay. So I'll stop the questions and actually get you to the bottom line. Then I want to be able to jump into our lesson for today as well. Okay. So all these observatories were alerted, and they all got on the bandwagon. I said 952 different research institutions were involved. Over 4,600 astronomers were involved. That's more than one-third of the total population of research astronomers in the world. So the biggest collaborative science effort ever done, literally, in the history of mankind. But the reason for that is that the scientists were so interested. Okay, here we got a neutron star merging event. We've had all these theories about neutron star mergers, but we've never had the opportunity to put them to the test. And so what they're able to do, for example, is through all these observations, actually go back to the theory and say, this part was right, this part needs to be adjusted. Bottom line, they're able to determine that all gamma ray bursts that are shorter than about 2 seconds are neutron star mergers. And we actually see quite a few of those. There's satellites up there now that are actually observing a gamma ray burst, which can be anywhere from milliseconds up to even a few hours. And they actually detect an average of about one per day. So they're happening all over the universe. And but the ones that are shorter than 2 seconds, we now know are the mergers of two neutron stars because of all these multi-wavelength observations. The other thing was that there was a theory out there saying neutron star mergers should give us a kilonova. You say, what's a kilonova? Well, kilo means thousand. It means a nova that's thousands of times brighter than an ordinary nova. And so, you know, two neutron stars are going to give you a big bright flash that'll last for several days. So that was established. Kilonovas have been observed before, but this is the first time they ever actually prove that it's a direct result of neutron star merger. But the thing that got all the news and the excitement is that because of these multi-wavelength observations, they're able to determine for the first time that the majority of the R process elements come from neutron star mergers. You say, what are R process elements? Well, R process stands for rapid neutron exposure. And basically what's happening is you take elements that are lighter than iron and you shower them with neutrons and they become heavier elements. But you need the neutron flux to be actually more intense than the decay of these products. Because elements heavier than iron, if you throw a lot of neutrons on them, they're going to decay. But in this case, the neutron bombardment is actually greater than that. That's why it's called rapid neutron capture process. That's what our process stands for, rapid neutron capture. And so they now know that these two merging neutron stars indeed efficiently do this. And the bottom line is, virtually all the gold in the universe comes from neutron star mergers. So I saw Ross Hoagland over there flashing his gold ring. You can thank God for designing the universe so that there's neutron star mergers, that you got enough gold there. So, that's also true of the entire platinum group. So platinum, palladium, osmium, gold and silver, that all comes from these neutron star mergers. A little bit of it comes from other stars, but we now know that neutron star mergers account for the vast majority. And two very important elements, uranium and thorium. They're also R process elements. Yes?
I'm not sure what Todd asked, but what are the theological implications?
I'm getting there. Okay. I gave you the bottom line. I told you it's a fine-tuning thing. Okay. What we know is, if a neutron star merger were to happen in our galaxy tomorrow, we'd all be, as human beings, be extinct. The cockroaches might survive, but we wouldn't. And your dogs and cats wouldn't survive either. In fact, it is such that we know that neutron star merging events would eliminate the possibility of advanced life, and that is the case for 90% of the galaxies in the universe. In other words, we can eliminate 90% of the galaxies in the universe as a candidate for advanced life simply based on what we now know must be the population of neutron star merging events. Now, our planet is super endowed with uranium and thorium. To give you an idea, we have 340 times as much uranium here on planet Earth as what we'd anticipate any other rocky planet of a similar size to possess. And we have 630 times as much thorium. And so we are living on the uranium-thorium champion of the universe. But what that means is, when the Earth was first forming, it must have been exposed to relatively nearby neutron star merging events in order to have our planet so super endowed with uranium and thorium and gold, silver, platinum, osmium, etc. You say, what do we need all that stuff for? The only reason why advanced life is possible here on planet Earth is because of how incredibly rich our planet is in uranium and thorium. Uranium and thorium are radiometric, but they're long-lived radiometric. For example, uranium-238, its half-life is about 4.4 billion years. Thorium is 14.1 billion. So they're radioactive, but they're radioactive with long half-lives, which means, and because of how abundant uranium and thorium is here on planet Earth, they provide a long-lasting, efficient source of internal heat. And because of that internal heat, it sets up a dynamo in the core of our Earth, which establishes a powerful, long-lasting magnetic field. So what do we need that for? If it wasn't for our long-lasting, powerful magnetic field, solar particles would erode away our atmosphere, and we wouldn't have an atmosphere. But thanks to that magnetic shield, that doesn't happen. Also, thanks to that magnetic shield, we don't get killed by solar radiation particles or by cosmic rays. And so, for example, when we send men to the moon, we only send them for a few days. And we very carefully watch what's happening with the magnetic field of the Earth. Because like with the Apollo mission, for example, we would send them out in a spacecraft and they'd be shielded by the magnetic field, say for the first day. They'd be on the moon where they wouldn't be shielded, then they would come back under the shield so they wouldn't get that much exposure to solar and cosmic radiation. And then they would pick the right time to go to the moon, one where you've got the solar radiation balancing with the cosmic radiation so those astronauts would get minimal exposure. But when you're here on Earth, you're very well protected from both solar radiation, deadly solar radiation, and cosmic radiation. But here's an even more important benefit from having all those nearby neutron star merging events for the primordial Earth and getting us so super enriched with uranium and thorium. Because of that uranium and thorium, we have plate tectonics. And if you're not familiar with the term, our planet has a crustal surface, but it's broken up into plates. And the plates move with respect to one another. Maybe there's been an occasion here living in Southern California where you felt some of that movement. And because of plate tectonics, our planet was transformed from a water world. Planet Earth began with no continents. An ocean covered the whole surface. But thanks to plate tectonics, we have oceans and continents coexisting. And they have coexisted for the past 3.8 billion years. The same window of time in which life has been abundant here on planet Earth. And you need a planet with both surface oceans and surface continents to recycle the nutrients that you need to have long-lasting life on planet Earth. I know Thanksgiving Day is coming up. You might want to thank God for all the uranium and thorium that exists here on the Earth. And incidentally, when you eat your dinner, you'll be consuming some of that uranium and thorium. Not enough to kill you, but enough so that you're not going to live as long as Methuselah lived. So, because of that, our planet's able to recycle nutrients. And incidentally, the optimal continental coverage for advanced civilization is 29%. I got a book on my shelf that says the continents are continuing to grow because of plate tectonics. They are being eroded, but they're also growing thanks to plate tectonics. And if we're talking human global civilization, it doesn't work when it's 28%. It doesn't work when it's 30%. It works when it's 29%. And that's where we are. We wouldn't be there if it wasn't for all that uranium and thorium. But keep in mind, gold and platinum and silver and palladium and osmium also have very useful industrial purposes. It's not just jewelry. These are metals that don't corrode easily. They have high conductivity. And in your electronics, there's lots of those platinum group metals, and we wouldn't be able to have the electronics we have today without that. And if any of you have had cancer or know a relative that has cancer, often as platinum group compounds that they use as chemotherapy drugs. And so it enables us to live longer because we have a planet where we got access to those things. And incidentally, there are actually bodies that are super endowed with these platinum group metals. In fact, there is an asteroid in the main belt that's very richly endowed with these platinum group metals, so richly endowed that there are plans afoot. Why don't we go out there and mine that thing? In fact, they've actually put a price tag on it. It's in the quadrillions of dollars, how valuable that asteroid is. And so, yeah, there's actually serious plans to go out there and capture that asteroid, bring it into a lunar orbit, mine it, and make a lot of money. So, but again, it's thanks to these neutron star mergers that you've got bodies like that running around in our solar system. And keep this in mind. If it wasn't for those R process elements, we humans would probably still be in the Stone Age. Because what was it that launched metallurgy? It was humans mining these platinum group metals. You know, it was gold and silver. Why? Because you can find raw gold and silver out there, and it's very easy to transform that into a pure metal because of the fact that it doesn't corrode well. I mean, you know, you've heard of gold nuggets. We can actually find a nugget of pure gold. You don't have to process it like you do iron or copper or lead ores. It's available right away as a metal. And so those are the first metals that humans exploited, gold and silver. And that led them to go to copper, which is another, you know, a little easier metal to process than all the other metals. But what if we didn't have something so easy to exploit as a gold and silver? Would we ever gotten to the point where we would have been processing iron to make steel? I don't think so. So when you celebrate Thanksgiving, here's a couple of things you can thank God for in terms of fine-tuning. You can thank God that when God formed the solar system, he put the solar system in a cluster of stars where there were lots of supernova eruptions, where we actually had binary giant stars that would form neutron stars that would merge together. And hence we got richly endowed with all that stuff. And that same God made sure we got all the enrichment we needed and then kicked us out of that cluster. Because if we'd stayed there, there would have been no chance for advanced life. You don't want a bunch of stars around you. You want them far away. It's not going to disturb the orbits of the planets or where the radiation isn't going to kill the advanced life. But that's something I write about an improbable planet. How we now know that our star and its original set of planets was actually birthed in a giant cluster of stars close to the center of our galaxy, where it got enriched with these R process elements. And then once it was enriched, it got gravitationally kicked out from the most dangerous part in our galaxy to the safest part of our galaxy for advanced life. And that's something that really is miraculous, how we got this amazing discharge from this star cluster, sent out a high velocity, and as soon as we got to the safe spot, it stopped. It could have kept on going, but it stopped just at the right place for advanced life today. And now we happen to be living in a galaxy that's isolated from other galaxies. In fact, what I was showing people, I should have done this for you, I didn't have time to prepare it, but I could show you a slide. In fact, I think it's going to be, I might even have it on my Facebook post tomorrow, basically showing what a typical cluster of galaxies looks like, and then what our galaxy cluster looks like, and how the galaxies are far apart with no giant galaxies. What does this mean? We're not at risk today for a nearby merger event of two neutron stars. If that were to happen into our galaxy, as I said, the cockroaches might survive, but we wouldn't. So Thanksgiving Day, you might want to thank God for the fact we happen to be living in a galaxy where the probability of that happening is really low, and there aren't any other galaxies in our vicinity that are going to cause those kinds of problems, whereas everywhere else in the universe, this seems to be a relatively common phenomena. On the other hand, we had lots of that happening when the Earth was forming. So those are your two fine-tuning things. We had a superabundance when we needed it, when the Earth was forming, so we could get all those R process elements, and right now we're wonderfully protected from those events. But as an astronomer, I can tell you, it's really neat that we can observe them in other galaxies. Well, if you don't have to observe them in our galaxy, we can observe them in other galaxies. And this was 130 million light years away, far enough away where it poses no risk to us. But close enough that we can actually observe this thing and learn about all this exciting evidence that shows us more of the handiwork and the glory of God. So that's the bottom line. The principle you see in Psalms and you see in the book of Job, the more we learn about the realm of nature, the more evidence we see for the supernatural handiwork of God. And thanks to your taxpayer dollars, we've been able to see much more of that glory through these gravity wave telescopes. Yes, Ross.
What was the mechanism, do we know, that kicked us out of the high-density star region?
Okay. We know we don't even know where that cluster is today. We do know we must have been born in a very dense cluster of stars, at least 10,000 member stars, maybe 30,000, 50,000, and then kicked out. Because otherwise we wouldn't be alive today. And what would have kicked us out? It would have been a gravitational encounter. So after we got enriched with all these R-process elements, and after we had some of the volatiles stripped away by aluminum-26, which is a highly radioactive short half-life element, which would have gotten rid of a lot of the carbon and nitrogen. Carbon and nitrogen are essential for life, but most planets like the Earth have like 1,000 times as much as we do. And that would have been a problem. Too much of a good thing can be a big problem. I explained why an improbable planet, but again, exposure in that cluster is what did it. So we know for sure we had to be born in that kind of cluster, and what kicked us out would have been a couple of giant stars in our vicinity gravitationally interacting with our sun to eject the sun. A similar thing happened in our solar system. I mean, we know of 8 planets in our solar system today, but the configuration of our planets tells us that the primordial solar system must have had 10 planets. And, one wound up merging with the Earth, and that formed the Moon. The other one was a planet about the size of Uranus and Neptune that got ejected. And it got ejected by a gravitational interaction with Jupiter and Saturn. As Jupiter and Saturn migrated towards the Sun and migrated back out, it ejected one of the 3 what we call ice giants. The gas giants are Jupiter and Saturn, the ice giants are Uranus, Neptune, and then this 3rd one that got ejected. Well, a similar thing happened to the entire solar system. It got ejected from its birth cluster, shot outward through the galaxy, and then when it got to just inside the co-rotation distance, it stopped being ejected. And you say, what would have stopped it? Another interaction with a group of stars would have brought it to a halt. But the fine tuning is amazing, because you need the stars to be in just the right position, just the right configuration to get the ejection to work at all, and you need the velocity to be just right to eject us far enough to get out there, and then when you finally get to the right spot, you need another fine-tuned gravitational interaction with stars to get it to stop into just the right zone. Now, I wrote about this in Improbable Planet and says miracle is written over the whole thing, because we get ejected at just the right time, not too soon, not too late, at just the right velocity, in just the right direction. That takes an amazing configuration of stars to get that gravitational ejection to work. And a similar thing happens when we get to the safe spot. Somehow we stop at exactly the best spot for us human beings today. So a few more things you can thank God for at Thanksgiving. And people joke with me saying, how long do you have to wait before you actually get to eat your food at Thanksgiving when you're thanking God for all these things? My sons make sure that I don't go on too long with these things, but I try to encourage them, hey, while we're eating, we can continue to thank God for the possibility of eating this amazing food. Yes?
Yeah. Normally understand that most of the platinum, the R-type elements, were formed in supernovas. My question is, now that we've seen this, the neutrons, does this change our understanding of where a lot of these elements come from?
That's exactly it. It's changed our understanding. That change would not have happened if we hadn't seen this neutron star merging event and these 70 observatories and satellites getting all the data that they got from the merging event. It basically told them, because they used to think really big supernova eruptions are responsible for the R-process elements. We now know they make some. but the vast majority are made by these neutron star merging events. So that's changed our whole thinking on the origin of our process. And yeah, I've been reading this literature for the last 15 years, and of course, we know our process elements exist because there's so many of them here on Earth, but there's been a big debate over the past 15 years, exactly where do they come from and how do we get so much of them? And so this event that happened on August 17th has basically solved that problem. And incidentally, I got an article coming out tomorrow on my Facebook page. You won't believe the things that astronomers are saying. Things like this is the moment of a lifetime. I mean, astronomers are literally ecstatic about this thing. I am too, but for a different reason. Not that it's solved all these problems and mysteries, but the fact that it reveals the handiwork of God in a way we've never known before. So, but I'll give you actually a couple of quotes from these astronomers.
Maybe that doesn't have much significance in our overall understanding of, you know, of the whole development of the universe coming from the initial creation event. But I mean, I suggest that it doesn't have a lot to. It won't change much in that whole story. This is kind of a question, is what I'm asking whether that will really change much in the whole story, as opposed to just addressing this.
Well, here's some more consequences of the discovery. I mean, I remember my colleague Dave Rogstad talking about a class he took on nucleosynthesis from Willie Fowler at Caltech, and just how difficult that class was. One of the reasons why that class was so difficult is they understood where the elements lighter than iron came from, and what they call the slow process elements heavier than iron. Our process was a big mystery. And I remember Dave telling me when he took that course from Willie Fowler, things really got confused and complex when we were talking our process, mainly because we didn't have the observations. A lot of the theory was there, but we didn't know what was correct. And that's one reason why 4,600-plus astronomers got involved in this thing, because they said, finally, we have an opportunity to get a complete and accurate story of the entire nucleosynthesis that we see going on in the universe. And the bottom line for that is, it's another underpinning of the Big Bang creation model that the Bible predicted thousands of years ago. Because some of the doubt that's been thrown out there is, hey, we don't have a good handle on this R process stuff, and maybe there's something fundamentally that needs to be adjusted about the Big Bang creation model. I've actually read some papers in the literature that have been suggesting that, and so this has taken away that mystery and ambiguity. It looks like the R process thing is now well established as to where all that stuff comes from and how it gets here, and there's a lot of excitement about the next neutron star merging event. And so some of the excitement is maybe we can get a little more funding for making more gravity wave telescopes, because one of the big challenges was this. The reason why this was so successful is it was seen at three different sites, Italy, Louisiana, and then Washington. And with those three different sites, they were able to triangulate and narrow down the region where this event took place to within 60 square degrees. That's still not that accurate. And so the astronomers had to immediately get on, you know, saying, okay, where are we seeing some new kind of radiation within that 60 degrees? And so that's one reason why there was such an intense effort, is that the window is quite broad that we need to search, and if we don't do an all-out effort, we could miss it, because they knew within a few days it would be over. But the all-out effort, they were able to find the place, they found the gamma ray burst, they were able to get a better position. Then the radio astronomers came in, the optical astronomers. They've even pinpointed the galaxy, and they know exactly where in this galaxy the event took place. Now, there's a lot of talk saying maybe we can get funding for a fourth or a fifth gravity wave telescope, put it somewhere else on the Earth, because if you've got four or five of these things, then instead of having a 60 square degree search area, you might be able to narrow it down to a 1 degree search area, in which case, we have the potential of learning a whole lot more physics with a lot less financial investment than we do right now. So that's something we might be able to look forward to. But these are amazing instruments, and they're not that cheap to build. but they're a lot cheaper than particle accelerators.
The instrument in Italy, is that the same design as we have here in the U.S.?
It's the same design, but it's a little bit smaller. The laser arms are only 3 kilometers rather than 4 kilometers. So it doesn't have quite the sensitivity of the ones in Washington and Louisiana. But yeah, we could even get a fourth one of these things in a distinctly different location. Pinpointing the location of these things could be a lot better. Yes?
What is the name of your Facebook page?
Oh, you put in Hugh Ross Facebook, it'll pop right up. I mean, there are other Hugh Rosses out there. There's artists and bodybuilders. I'm not the artist. I'm not the bodybuilder. However, I do have the biggest Facebook under Hugh Ross. If you put in Hugh Ross Facebook, it'll be the first one that pops up. So I don't know the address. I'm thinking it's RTB Hugh Ross, something like that. But the easier way to do it is just pop it into a search engine. It'll come up. So, okay, yes.
Does an event like this definitely support a Big Bang model versus cyclical universe?
Well, where it supports the Big Bang creation model that we see the Bible predicting thousands of years ago is how it solves all the nucleosynthesis mysteries that we had. So basically, there's no longer any doubt that nucleosynthesis is consistent with Big Bang cosmology. Yeah, and because we had that, mystery about the R process, they were saying, well, we really don't have a complete model, and this has nailed that down. So that's the biggest contribution. And then people have been commenting, if the universe was slightly different, we wouldn't have all this gold and platinum here on the Earth, and we certainly wouldn't have all the uranium and thorium, and we wouldn't even be here. There wouldn't be astronomers if it wasn't for these neutron star merging events. So something else to thank God for at Thanksgiving. Okay.
Hello.
Yes? Oh, got two more questions?
Question.
Okay. Okay, I'll take his because he hasn't asked one. Go for it.
With the technology we have today, with that ice giant planet that got kicked out of our solar system, are astronomers getting close to finding where that gas giant might actually be?
Yes, and if you scroll back on my Facebook page, you'll actually find an article on that. And a little bit of it is in Improbable Planet, in the sense that astronomers, in trying to explain the configuration, especially Mars. Mars was the most difficult planet to explain our solar system. All the models were saying it should be a lot bigger, and yet it's small. And that's why they figured out that there had to be an ice giant that got ejected to explain the configuration of the rocky planets, why Earth is the biggest and not Mars being the biggest. But what they've now seen is out in the Kuiper belt of asteroids and comets, which is billions of years farther away than Neptune, they're seeing the orbits of the bigger comets crossing over one another in such a way that they believe it's the signal of a gravitational disturbance from a very distant ice giant planet. Say, well, how distant are we talking about? Well, if indeed this crossover of comet orbits is the signal of a gravitational disturbance from an ice giant, it would have to be 50 times farther away from us than Neptune is from us. Neptune is about 3 to 3.5 billion miles away from us, so that puts this thing out at about 150 to 160 billion miles. There's a search going on for it right now. Now, the way the orbits cross, it doesn't necessarily have to be the signal of an ice giant, but it could be. And so the people who worked out the model of trying to explain why Mars, Earth, Venus, and Mercury look the way they'd done, they said, there's two ways we can make it happen. The ice giant gets completely ejected and is no longer part of the solar system, or it gets ejected to the extreme outer fringe of our solar system. So if we can find that planet, or if we can prove it doesn't exist, it's going to enable us to come up with an even more precise model for the formation of the solar system. And I believe it's going to uncover more fine-tuning evidence that will show the handiwork of God. And so within the next 2 years, we should know whether or not that planet is still in the outer fringes of our solar system. There's a search going on for it right now. When they discover it, I'll let you know. Okay. Yeah, quick, and then I got to wrap up.
Okay, you know I love you, and you're one of my mentors, and I look up to you and all that, but it seems like you're saying everything could be explained naturally, and God's like over it all. It's not so much like he's injecting the planet like that. I mean, everything has a naturalistic explanation. Does the scientific community recognize any of this being kind of miraculous or fine-tuned? Or
okay.
That's also the last question, comment.
All right. But it's a good question he's raising, and it's one I've had to face on both Twitter and Facebook frequently from Christians who say, hey, you're denying the miraculous. And you can read some of my responses, basically making the point. God is not limited in his toolkit of miracles. One of his tools is he does something transcendently. Jesus walking on top of the Sea of Galilee is something he did from beyond the laws of physics. I think we can all understand that gravity doesn't usually work that way. When God created the universe, he did it from beyond space, time, matter, and energy. That's a transcendent miracle, and that's one of the miracles that God has in his toolkit. But a tool he uses more frequently is where he doesn't violate the laws of physics, he controls and works with the laws of physics to get the result he wants. It's still a miracle in the same way that it's a miracle. In other words, put it this way. You're not going to get a car from raw iron ore unless you've got humans processing that ore, manufacturing it, putting the pieces together, and making an automobile. Simply letting a tornado whip through an iron ore mine is not going to get you an automobile. There needs to be someone manufacturing and working with that. Likewise, I would argue that things like what happened to the solar system, where it was born, where it wound up, that's not going to happen unless you've got somebody controlling the natural process in a way that just simple natural process without God's intervention would bring about. Now, people will say, well, it's all coincidences. Well, likewise, I could argue maybe a tornado can go through a junkyard and make an airplane that you can fly on. I would be a little nervous about flying on such an aircraft. That could happen. You say, just an amazing coincidence. But when you begin to chalk up all the coincidences, you realize, no, you really need the supernatural handiwork of God, actually working with the raw material, manufacturing it in the same way we would take iron ore and copper ore and different plastic products that we get from oil and we make an automobile. It's not going to happen if we just simply sit back and let the natural process run. And when you read the Old and New Testament, most of the miracles that are described in the Bible are in that category. I'll give you one example of such a miracle that the Bible calls a miracle. You've got Deborah, and she's facing the enemies of Israel. And what does God tell her? Take the army of Israel up to the top of, what's that mountain's name that's in the valley of Jezreel? I'm trying to think of the name. It's a 2,000-foot peak. I've been there. Just can't think of the biblical name. Happens when you get to be my age. Okay? But what the Lord says, take the Israel army up to the top of the mountain. And then we got the army of Sisera, the enemies of Israel. They're at the bottom of the mountain. And if you've been to that place, it's a big flat plain with a single mountain in the middle. Okay. What happened? A torrential rainstorm mired the chariots of Sisera's army. So here's his army at the bottom of Mount Tabor. That's the name. At the bottom of Mount Tabor, here's Sisera with all his mud. His soldiers are exhausted from trying to deal with all the mud. Their chariots being mired. And meanwhile, up at the top of Mount Tabor, it's dry. No rain's coming down. Okay, if you're a meteorologist, you know that the higher the elevation, the wetter it's going to be. I mean, we see that here. Mount Wilson gets a lot more rain than Long Beach does. And the closer you are to the foothills, the more rain you're going to get. You know, where I live, we get about twice as much rain as downtown Los Angeles gets. That's because we're up a little higher, right up against the foothills. That's a miracle. The fact that the meteorology went the opposite way natural process would dictate. Dry, 2,000 feet up at the bottom, torrential rain, the troops got exhausted. And you know the story, the Israelite army won an easy victory that day because of God supernaturally controlling the weather. And notice this, he also supernaturally controlled the timing. So at just the right time, rain came down on the army of Sisera, and just the right time, the rain stopped. Because you don't want the rain coming down when the army comes down to meet Sisera. The rain stopped. The Sisera's army was all exhausted. Their chariots were useless. And here were all these fresh Israelite troops coming down the mountain. It's a little easier coming down than going up, as many of you know. And so that explains the victory. A miracle. Now, when it says that the ice axe floated to the top, that's a transcendent miracle. So, also I would say the fact that these wild ravens came and fed Elijah with enough food to keep him alive, that's a miracle. Because you could be sitting out in the middle of the San Gabriel Mountains with ravens all around you. I don't think that's going to happen to you. Moreover, look at how small those ravens are, that they were able to collect enough food to feed Elijah and themselves. I mean, again, and God said, I will send the ravens. Well, it wasn't the natural process sending the ravens. It was God actually sending the ravens out to him so he could be fed. So, thank you for asking the question. But the whole point is, and often atheists will stop us with this. They'll think that we Christians believe that the only miracles God performs are transcendent miracles. No. He also performs what I call transformational miracles, where he transforms what he already has created. And I'll give you a third category. It says he sustains the world so it can sustain life. You see this in a couple of places, Old Testament and New Testament, where God makes a claim. If I were to take away my sustaining hand, all life would immediately die. We'd all breathe our last breath. As it says in Colossians chapter 1, if God were to take away his sustaining hand, all the molecules would fall apart and all life everywhere would end. So it's a miracle that he's actually sustaining the universe in the state that he is. And we actually see this in the laws of physics, and we see this in particle physics. Amazing fine-tuning. So that you actually have atoms and molecules and life as possible. Some of the most exquisite fine-tuning we see in the universe is at the atomic level. With that, I'm out of time. And where I'm going to go next week, I'm going to be asking you a lot of questions. Okay? Because this past week, I was in North Carolina and South Carolina, and a lot of the questions I had to deal with was doubt. And I find that there's a lot of Christians that are fearful of doubts they have about God working in their lives. And maybe it's me, maybe it's because I was raised in a non-Christian home. I'm optimistic about doubts, but a lot of people get depressed about doubts. They say, how do you get optimistic? I look at a doubt as an opportunity to discover something. Okay? And I've had enough experience to realize that if I pursue a doubt, I'm going to get an answer, and when I do, it's going to reveal three or four more doubts that I didn't even know I had. But also another opportunities to learn things. And the biblical text I gave you 2 weeks ago actually fits right in with that. 1 Chronicles chapter 29 makes the point that if you seek after God, you will be found by God. He will find you. And we're going to apply that to the doubts that we have in our life. And the reason why God blesses us with doubts, he wants us to seek after him. And he says, if you do that, I'll answer your doubts. But I want to warn you, he'll give you more doubts than you had before. However, the doubts begin to diminish in terms of their significance. And actually, as a scientist, I prefer another term, anomaly. Anomaly is something that doesn't seem to fit and may cause you to doubt what you think you know to be true. We just talked about an example today. Okay, there was some doubts about this R process thing. And it literally took 30 years of research, 40 years actually, for that doubt to get resolved. And when it did, it basically solved a major problem. But something else I'll share, it's going to open up more problems. And you know that's what's exciting. But we can discover a few more of these neutron star mergers. It's going to expose more doubts and anomalies that we couldn't possibly investigate before. And that's what's so exciting about science. It's also what's so exciting about theology. Because there's always things in Scripture that are anomalies and bring about doubt, but they're opportunities to learn. That's what this class is all about. We pursue those things. That's what we call this class paradoxes. We go after the anomalies and the doubts. So hopefully I can inspire some enthusiasm and optimism about doubts in your life. But yeah, I'm going to actually be featuring some books that have been written by famous theologians, basically saying how catastrophic doubts can be in the life of Christians, but if looked at in the right way, they can be a very valuable process of growth. So 1 Chronicles 29, and also I'm going to encourage you, read the last paragraph of the book of Ecclesiastes. It fits in beautifully with 1 Corinthians 29, verses 8 and 9. Do that next week. Let me bow in prayer. Father in heaven, I want to thank you for this opportunity all of us had to be your people in the 21st century. Lord, we're the most populous generation that's ever lived and the most technologically advanced. And what a thrill, Father, to be living in a day when we can see your miraculous hand. Lord, the disciples got to see miracles, but we're getting to see miracles too by these amazing discoveries that are happening in the book of nature that you've given us to read and study. Thank you for giving us the capability to research nature to the depth that we can today. And I pray, Father, that you give many of us in this class opportunities to share the implications of the discoveries and how they reveal your handiwork and your glory in a way that's never been revealed before. And may we see many people receive more of your life, truth, and love, and give their lives and faith to Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you.